Hold on to your butts.
Da-da-da! Oh, hello.
Welcome to episode 126 of the Civil War Breakfast Club podcast. As always, I'm joined by Mary, a woman who has had many a drink on a river. I am merely a deserted island with a face that can stop a ship named Darren. What? Hello, Mary. How are you?
I wish I could say I had many a drink on a river, but I don't think I...
Oh, please. Good Lord. A river, a street, a parking lot, you name it. You've had many a drink. It's all good. How are you? It's happy Friday to you, Mary.
Yes, happy Friday to you, too.
Anyway. So how's it going with you? How's the week been? How's the mood going?
It's been busy.
Yeah, it has been. It has been. It's great to see Friday. It's great to Friday. Great to record again. We haven't recorded in a couple of weeks. Last time we did this, I believe it was Claiborne, right?
It was our episode about Patrick Claiborne. We spent two episodes in March that we talked just about the Irish Brigade on the Union side and then Confederate General Patrick Claiborne for our Confederate episode.
So this one will be a fun one we're going to talk about tonight. But before we get into the details of this episode, Mary, I'm going to be a fantastic host. And I'm going to merely ask you that simple question, of course. And that is, what are you drinking on this fine Friday evening?
I just had to check what it was called. I'm drinking Sunbuzz by Winter Hill Brewing, which I think is in a brewery in Massachusetts. And I'm drinking it out of my Unconditional Surrender mug with, obviously, Ulysses S. Grant on it, because that's as close as I could get to a mug for this episode. And I honestly could not find the Fort Sumter mug because we were recording on the anniversary of the firing upon Fort Sumter.
That is true. Anyway,
what are you drinking?
Oh, thank you so much. I was getting around to one you were going to ask me. I'm drinking, it's called Comeback Brew IPA. It's from nearby Untold. I'm drinking it here. It is, of course, this is the beer that is going to be basically after the Boston Marathon, which is going on here next Monday in these parts. And that's why I'm drinking that. And I'm drinking it out of my Boston College hockey mug, Mary, because it's a big weekend here in my world. They are going to play for the national championship this weekend. So by the time this drops, well, actually, it won't drop later, but we'll find out for sure. So I'm excited about it. The whole region is pumped. Anyway, so we're going to have some fun tonight, Mary. We're going to talk about a very underrated battle that took place right at the beginning of the war. Mm-hmm. And that is a battle that took place along the Mississippi River near the town of New Madrid, Missouri, a small island, called Island Number 10. And, you know, at the time, you know, Island Number 10 was nothing more than a small little sandbar situated in the middle of the Mississippi River at the bottom of a U-shaped bend occupied by a guy named James Rice, who owned a handful of slaves. And he's basically there working his cornfield and his fruit orchards. And though only a mile long and barely 500 yards wide at the time of the Civil War, you know, Island Number 10 is going to prove to be a barrier that would need to be broken for the Union to begin its control of the Mississippi River, setting up future battles such as the battle and the siege of Vicksburg.
Yeah. The Mississippi River is kind of, I mean, as President Abraham Lincoln, he would say, you know, Vicksburg is the key. But part of that is getting control of the rivers. And as we're going to see, the Union, you know, throughout the Civil War is constantly in the Western theater anyway, getting control of these rivers. So you have the Mississippi, you have the Tennessee, and they need them. Basically, it goes back to General in Chief Winfield Scott's Anaconda Plan, just to kind of choke them, basically, and sever where they can get supplies and all that. And that's why these rivers are so important. And where Island Number 10 sits is, like, you know, it's a small island, as you said, but as we're going to talk about, it's pretty strategic where it is, because it makes passing down the river going downstream pretty much impossible just because of the bend at where it sits.
Yeah, it's in the middle of the river. And if you look at it from the sky, it looks like a hair clog in the middle of a pipe that you see in a Drano commercial, kind of, right? But for the Union Navy to move down the river, it had to be taken. You know, not only did the Confederacy not want the Union ships to sailing down the river, this area is also a crucial economic area for the Rebs. So, you know, that Mississippi Valley, you know, was a powerful slaveholding area whose economic interests would be drastically threatened in case of a federal invasion. So the locals in that valley, they're going to be pressuring the Confederate government, you know, to fortify several points along this river. And it's going to lead to the establishment of forts called Fort Thompson and Fort Bankhead, along with the enforcement, the reinforcement of Island Number 10. Now, Island Number 10, of course, it gets its name because it's the 10th island south of the confluence of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. I mean, clearly the guy for this. I mean, the only guy lazy was the guy who came up with the Japanese flag design, if you ask me, for whoever named this one, right?
And we've eliminated our Japanese listeners.
It's true, though. but aside from the forts, you know, the Rebs, you know, they use shore batteries, they use chains, you know, other natural obstructions, as well as any civil boats they could get their hands on, you know, to stop any boats from passing. And but they had no experience against going up against ironclads or anything like
The Union Navy kind of has got ahead of them with all this, with the construction of the ironclads, and the Confederates have these like wooden gunboats which can't stand up to the ironclads at all. But somehow the Union Navy, you know, we always talk about how the Confederates with the cavalry, you know, in the war for the most part until probably about mid-1863 are way ahead of the Union. The Union with their Navy boats, with their ironclads, are ahead of the Confederates here. And that's one of the things that is making them nervous, especially that coupled with Scott's Anaconda Plan is making men like, you know, Polk, who is in charge of an army at this point, making him really, really nervous.
No, there's no question. August 1861, a guy named Captain Andrew B. Gray, you know, he's going to begin to build earthworks on Island Number 10, you know, primarily using slave labor. There's such a vast slave, you know, abundance in that area, you know. But it took a while because, you know, they didn't have really any shovels, so they built these earthworks basically with their hands. You can only imagine that. Oh. But as much as, you know, as much as the focus on defending that area seemed important, other events in the area were overshadowing the defense of Island Number 10. Now, a larger rebel force, Leonidas Polk's 16,000 men army, where they're up the coast of Columbus, Kentucky, which was keeping their attention, the Confederates' attention focused there. This is when Union General John C. Fremont, you know, commander of that Western Department, he was ordered to take the town after U.S. Grant took Paducah, right? And despite Kentucky being, you know, quotation fingers neutral, these rebel eyes are focused on this area. So, you know, so with that, building the defenses on Island Number 10 really didn't get going until the fall. Mm-hmm. You know, to speed things up, you know, they use unarmed rebel soldiers to help build these earthworks. But there are problems, Mary. There are problems on Island Number 10. Okay. Forget the fact they ain't got no shovels, which is seems to me to be a pretty big problem. These white Confederate soldiers, guess what? They didn't like working side by side with slaves doing the same job. They didn't like that too much. They were their LinkedIn page did not include that on their resume, right? So Captain Gray, he was complaining about all these things about support and supplies, but they're getting primarily ignored by the rebel brass at this point. February of 1862, jump ahead a little bit. What's happening not too far away, Mary?
February
history quiz.
Oh, history quiz. I'm going drawing a complete blank.
Okay. There's going to be a guy named U.S. Grant, and he's going to attack a couple of forts.
Henry and Donelson.
Fort Henry and Fort Donelson. Okay. Perhaps you took social studies. But in any case, this is going to be the western end of Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnson's west line. And when Donelson falls, Johnson's west line collapses faster than the Bills in January. Gone, right? That's what's going to happen with them. But there's a silver lining for the Rebs, and that is they can finally begin to focus now on this building, this defense on the north side of the Mississippi River near those towns, that town I mentioned, New Madrid, Missouri, and Island Number 10. Now, you know, like I said earlier, it has two sharp bends at the Kentucky bend of this river. One goes hard south and forms a U, and then jumps north and makes a lowercase N near New Madrid. If you can imagine that, it looks like a snake. The bottom of the U is Island Number 10. The top of the little N, a little northwest, is New Madrid.
Well, it almost is like the river starts to almost like run parallel. Once you get past the bend, the river almost runs parallel to where it was before. I'm probably not explaining that very well, but I encourage our listeners to have a look at it on a map, because it's really like the bend is crazy.
And it's only 7 miles apart. So we're talking of not a lot of difference. Now, this area is an extremely tough part of the river to sail through, and a fantastic one to defend, or so it would seem, as the Rebs really focus on this defense of this area by February of 1862. On the Union side, General Henry Halleck, commander of the Department of Missouri at the time. How about that? Okay. He's going to realize the strategic importance of Island number 10. So he's going to set a plan in motion. Okay. Instead of sending troops like he's originally thought to Tennessee, he's going to reroute them to Commerce, Missouri, which is about 45 miles north of New Madrid, mm-hmm. and about 50 miles northwest of Cairo, Illinois. Okay, if you know the area, okay, that's where this is. Halleck is going to select Brigadier General John Pope to command these troops. So on February 18, 1862, John Pope will be ordered to command this 25,000-man Army of the Mississippi and task them to removing all rebel resistance from New Madrid and Island number 10 on the north side of the Mississippi, mm-hmm. to open it to federal troops. Okay, that's what he's going to do.
It would have been common at this time, though, for them to go into winter quarters. That's the thing, is they are campaigning at a time that it would not have been normal to campaign. And Pope is, instead of, you know, he's going to get his men ready to campaign when they should have been going into winter quarters for a few weeks to kind of wait out the weather, mm-hmm. a little bit. Not that it's that bad there, but still, that was the common practice of the time. So
that's no picnic in Missouri. Yeah,
he's beginning the campaign season probably, I don't know, 3-4 weeks earlier than what would be normal.
You know, we've talked a little bit about this Kentucky native John Pope in a couple different episodes. He's most famous for being dumped to Minnesota and sent to the Dakota War after First Manassas, and later peeing down his leg at Second Manassas. So obviously Manassas, Virginia ain't his place.
McClellan is not a fan of Pope.
No, he isn't. But here Pope gets another shot at commanding the Army of the Mississippi. And he's going to get to command 5 pretty good infantry divisions. And he's actually going to do very well here. This is going to be one of his high watermarks. He's going to command 5 divisions. He's going to have David Stanley's Ohio and Illinois Brigade, mm-hmm. John Palmer's Indiana Brigade, Gordon Granger's Illinois men, James Plummer's Brigade of Illinois, Wisconsin, and Missouri men, and Schuyler Hamilton's Brigade of Indianans, Iowans, and Missourians. Now, not a lot of people have heard of Schuyler Hamilton, but perhaps they've heard of his grandfather, who was a founding father and his first secretary of the treasury, had a play made about him. I think his name was Alexander something.
Alexander,
this is his
Hamilton.
Grandson.
Oh, really? That's his, so cool. Grand,
his grandson, Schuyler, is running one of the divisions here. Okay. Yeah. And so basically a week or so later, on February 28th of 1862, Pope is going to begin to move his army south and take the town of Sykeston, Missouri, which is a railroad hub, which is going to basically be his supply hub for his operations against Island number 10 in New Madrid. Now, while moving south towards New Madrid, Pope is going to first meet rebel resistance on March 1st. Mm-hmm. And it's primarily trooped by the Missouri National, you know, obviously, yeah. his local guard. So that's pretty much what it's going to be. But New Madrid, had been occupied by the Confederates since they fell back in early 1862. And the garrisons of New Madrid in Island number 10 were now commanded by General John Porter McCown's mm-hmm. army of 77 or so hundred men. Now, those two forts I mentioned before near New Madrid, Forts Thompson and Fort Bankhead, they're going to be commanded by Brigadier General Edward Gantt and Lucius Walker. Now, these pretty much are guys from Arkansas, Tennessee, Alabama, and they're going to be under the overall command of General Alexander Stewart.
Yep.
Now, these aren't household names, but that's who these people are.
Although it's okay? Fine. So, I was just thinking, though, that sometimes, this is just a random thought, but sometimes you can, it's kind of like, guess what side they were on? Like, a name like Lucius is so common for the Confederates. Have you ever noticed that?
It seems to be it's like the Jennifer of the 1850s.
Lucius, but it's all like everyone. Confederates have that name.
Oh, absolutely. You know, but basically General Gantt, you know, he's going to famously say of this defense at New Madrid in late February that we will make a splendid defense. That was a quote he said. Okay,
well,
whatever.
That aged well.
That's true. But they're going to get their chance when Pope's army advanced and got nearby on March 3rd. Mm-hmm. They're going to start approaching New Madrid. Now, when Pope arrived, it's pouring. It's friggin' pouring rain, yeah. like it's been here for the last 6 months, right? and it's going to flood the Mississippi and all the swamps that surround New Madrid. If you know the area, when the Mississippi gets flooded in the spring, there's a bunch of swamps and lakes in the area that all flood.
Yep.
And this is the timing. This is all going to happen.
Grant's going to have fun with that in about a year.
He's going to. So what does Pope do? He decides to throw up the stop sign, and he's going to wait out the rain that's flooding the area, because it's the worst flood that's hit in years. The river's running extremely high, so he's going to kind of calm his army down. Now, knowing his men are within firing distance from the rebel guns on the Mississippi, he's going to make sure that they're just out of range. He's going to back off a little bit. He's just going to kind of cool his jets. He's waiting for three things. One, the weather to improve. Two, he's ordered through Amazon siege guns and mortars from New Cairo to come down from Illinois. The third thing he's waiting on is the most important piece of his puzzle, Mary.
Yep.
It is the flotilla of the Western flotilla of one flag officer, Andrew H. Foote.
Yep.
Now that's what he's going to want. Now we'll get to Foote in a second, but like I said, General John McCown, he's going to take command of the 7,700 man army at New Madrid and Island Number 10. And he is going to be made Brigadier General of this area on March 10th of 1862. Now, on the island, the garrison of Island Number 10 is going to be commanded by three brigades of infantry, by Rufus, don't call me Cam Neely, Samuel Marks and Alexander Stewart, as well as some cavalry in 10 companies of infantry under a guy named James Trudeau. No relation.
No relation to Justin?
No relation. I did look. Okay. Now, like I said, this total area is around 7,500 men out of the overall command, like I said, of John McCown. Now, McCown is a relatively obscure guy in overall history, but he's got an interesting history, Mary. I don't know if you studied him, but you'd be the only one if you ever did. He's born August 19, 1815 in Sevier County, Tennessee. He will attend West Point, graduate 10th out of 42 in the class of 1840. Who is in his class? Richard Ewell's in his class. Bushrod Johnson's in his class. Uncle Blingy himself, William T. Sherman's in his class. 1840, it's a star-studded class. After graduating, he's going to join the 4th U.S. Artillery as a second lieutenant. He's going to head to Texas in 1845, as well as Mexico, where he'll participate in the Battle of Cerro Gordo, which translates to Fat Mountain. It's kind of like Big Round Top. Think about it. That's kind of what the name
of
the mountain
is. Funnier if it translated into like another F mountain.
No, maybe it would. But after Mexico, he's going to end up staying along the Rio Grande frontier, where he's going to become fascinated by all things, guess what? Birds. He's going to be obsessed with birds.
Oh my God. Okay? I wondered if it happened after he turned 40, because that's what happened to me after I turned 40. I got into bird
watching.
Well,
here's the thing. McCown is going to start collecting them and identifying them while sitting on the Rio Grande.
That's actually really cool.
He is actually going to discover a new species of bird that will be named after him, called the McNown Longspur. True story.
Interesting.
Now, believe it, gets better. 2020, guess what happens? McCown's Longspur, by the American Ornithological Society, changes its name to the Thick-Billed Longspur. You know why?
Because
it's named after a Confederate general.
Oh, okay.
It is the first. It is the first case of a bird getting canceled off the Confederacy.
Okay, I get
true story.
Some of it, but a bird. We're really, come on.
That's what happens. And that's also poor McCown lost his bird name. Okay, but there's probably a bird will rise again joke somewhere in here. Who knows? We'll probably
the burbs will rise again.
Right? But McCown is going to find himself in the Dakotas when the Civil War is going to start, and he's going to resign his commission on May 17th of 1861 and be named Lieutenant Colonel of Artillery after receiving his star as a Brigadier General of the Infantry at Fort Pillow on October 12th, 1861. He'll see action at the Battle of Belmont before being named to this commander of the New Madrid Island 10 garrison on March 5th of 1862. Now, once he gets there, McCown is going to find out quickly that there's some problems, and he's going to begin to move men and material to that island. But these problems continue. Many of the carriages that he had brought to move his guns, guess what? They vanished. disappeared. And there's not a lot of lumber around to build new ones. So they've got to basically start moving these guns by hand. Oh, and by the way, a lot of the ammo was gone. You know why? Because the men use it for target practice because they were bored.
Oh, my God.
So you can just imagine the face palming that, that this poor guy has.
I was going to say, like,
he's got his birds, though. He's got his birds, right?
Well, only until 2020.
Until 2020. Throw in the fact the weather is brutal. The ground is wet, which is going to slow the placement of his artillery. But by March 13th, McCown is going to have 19 guns mounted on Island number 10, as well as 22 more set up along the Tennessee shore right across the river. Okay. You know, remember, the island's the middle. South of the island's Tennessee. North is Missouri. Okay. So picture to the right, south, so probably southeast, is Tennessee. There's a shore.
Yeah.
That's where you're going to basically start to see where he's going to place a lot of his guns. You know, by a week later, he's going to have 52 guns up in this area. So he's going to do a much, much better job positioning these guns at all these places. Places like Donaldson's Farm, that's where he's going to place them. Places like Eisler Farm, that's where he's going to start to load these guns on the Tennessee side. They're going to have to use sandbags and water pumps to keep the water out. And just, you can just imagine how miserable this experience must have been. So at this moment, Pope is still sitting north of New Madrid, and he's waiting for that artillery I mentioned, and he's waiting for Foote's Navy.
Yeah.
Still. And knowing this, McCown is going to want to reinforce the town of New Madrid. So he's going to have 3,000 troops set up there, and he wants to basically get these additional troops to attack Pope. Pope is just sitting around, just staring at each other. That's what he's doing. But what he wants to do, he sends out the bat signal to guess who? Earl Van Dorn in Arkansas. God.
EVD,
the place to be, right? But he, I don't know, he's washing his hair, whatever. He doesn't send anybody. He's busy. So
he's
probably
not washing his hair.
But the thing that McCown did get, though, and we don't talk a lot about the Confederate Navy, he gets a little help from the Confederate Navy.
Yeah.
And this is going to be 9 gunboats under the command of Commodore George N. Hollis. Mm-hmm. This is going to be 7 steamers plus 2 floating battalions, as well as the CSS New Orleans, which has 16 guns on it.
Yeah.
Hollis is a Baltimore guy, and he's one of the few federal Navy officers to leave to join the Confederacy. He had some early success and was the hero of the famous Battle of the Head of Passes, which I'm sure you've heard of, in Louisiana in 1861, where he defeated some Union blockade boats. Ironically, the guy he defeated was another guy named John Pope, different John Pope of all people. And where is he from? Sandwich, Massachusetts, up the street here, my former town. Yeah, the other John. One of three John Popes I know of in the Army in the Civil War.
So I was going to say, it's kind of like there's all these there's two Pembertons in the Army. I know they're in the same first name, but, or no, they did, didn't they? The two Pembertons.
What?
Pemberton?
Right. The Coke guy and the other guy, right?
Yeah, the Coke guy.
But Hollins is going to immediately place that CSS New Orleans. This is important. Just off the north side of Island number 10 to basically block the channel between Island number 10 and the Missouri side of the Mississippi River, right? Now, again, Pope is not sitting idly either. He's not doing anything while he's sitting just outside of New Madrid. On March 5th, he's beginning to move his chess pieces around the board while he's waiting for Foote's boats to arrive.
Yeah.
So he's running down the clock, but he's strategically moving his people. He's going to send one of his divisions under Joseph Plummer south to a place called Point Pleasant, who will set up some batteries along the Mississippi River south of New Madrid with the plan of firing on any rebel ships that happen to be coming up the river to assist the island. So he's setting up a defense. Plummer is also going to place Battery M from the 1st Missouri Artillery to a place called Riddle's Point in Tiptonsville, Tennessee. We'll talk more about that later on.
Tiptonsville's at the end.
And this is going to defend really all the land routes that the Rebs can use to access the island. Now, Island number 10 in this area had a great place to defend.
Yep.
And a lousy place to escape from. And a natural defense south of the island on the land side of the peninsula was surrounded on one side by the Mississippi and on the other side by a lake called Real Foot Lake. That was the name of it. Okay. It was a 15,000 acre lake and swamp created by an earthquake that hit the area in 1811. Yeah, an earthquake here for you.
I was just going to say, it's been 1 week since the earthquake.
Well, this earthquake created a 15,000 acre lake that was extremely important in the American Civil War. So there's some nature coming in. But by doing this, Pope is slowly bottling up the Rebs, which is going to make Island number 10 extremely difficult to defend if the Union can get boats past it. So it's kind of a bottleneck. It's great if you can defend it, but if you get beat, your JWL and, you know, yes. JWF, right? SOL and JWF, as they say, right? But that's what you're going to be. And meanwhile, McCown is left to basically kind of sit and watch all this stuff happening. He's seeing Pope move men around. There's nothing he can really do about it. He's trying to defend the Tennessee side. He's trying to defend New Madrid, and he's trying to defend Island number 10. He's trying to, but if he can do it, well, now we're talking. Yeah. But if he can't, you know, he's going to be in a little bit of trouble. McCown basically on March 10th is really when things are going to kind of go the other way. March 12th, I mean, this is when those siege guns and mortars are going to arrive from Cairo, and not long. Pope is going to place them within 1,000 yards of the rebel lines in New Madrid. He will have them ready to go pretty quickly by early March 13th. At first light, he's going to start a blasting.
Yeah.
He's going to start firing on New Madrid. And this is where McCown is going to face that first existential crisis that he's going to have to run into.
Yeah, he realizes that Pope would try and attack his forts by certain approaches, and he realizes like, well, I gotta do something, or else I'm not gonna be able to shift any troops to and from Island number 10 at all. And this is a big thing for him, as you said, it's like an existential crisis for him at this point.
Absolutely. What is he gonna do? He's gonna go outside. He's gonna blow his conch shell to bring the troops all back together again. Yep. And he's going to bring them all for an emergency council of war on a boat called the CSS McRae. And they're going to decide what to do. How are we going to handle this? Now we're being shelled. We know this Navy probably coming. What are we going to do? Hollins from the Confederate Navy says, I have an idea. Let's issue a special order GTFO and get the hell out of here.
That's exactly what happened at Donelson and Henry, wasn't
right.
it? With some of them?
And that's what he does. And the Navy goes, screw you guys, I'm going home. And they sail down the river. And for the most part, this Confederate Navy, except for the CSS New Orleans, we'll talk about later, disappears and leaves. Yep. They kind of go. McCown's next action basically is this. He is going to, for the most part, he's going to basically do something that's going to create a facepalm so loud from Jefferson Davis they could hear it from Richmond, okay, at this point. What he's going to do is this. He, like Hollins, is going to decide to vacate the dance floor, Mary, and abandon the entire town of New Madrid, that entire garrison, without a fight.
Yep.
He's just going to say the heck with this.
Well, he lucks out because the weather, I think, is such that he's able to just get out of there, GTFO out of there.
No, exactly. He is. So it's 11 p.m. on the night of March 13th.
Yeah.
The garrison is all going to board, this Confederate garrison is all going to board these boats and leave New Madrid during a really, really bad thunderstorm, to your point. So by dawn on the 14th, the last rebel steamer, it leaves the town goes across to the Tennessee side while the gunboats are sailing their way down towards Tippsonville. They're gone. Hollins thinks his fleet's going to be destroyed, so he sails away, and that's going to be it. He's gone. So John Pope, he stumbles into New Madrid, and he can't believe what he finds. He is completely stunned, and this what he finds is going to help inflate that ego of his that he's going to carry to Second Manassas.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he thinks, I show up, everyone takes off. Yeah. That's how awesome
I am. He finds out because there's two deserters that just randomly appear bearing a white flag, and they say to Pope, like, well, everyone else deserted and here we are. And for some reason, they stayed behind. I don't know if it was, I was kind of like, I thought that was weird that there's like these two deserters that have this white flag. It's like, were they left there deliberately or were they actually deserters? But yeah, I was going to say there's a lot of stuff that is happening here that I think is kind of factoring into the arrogance we see of Pope at Second Manassas with that, you know, in the West, we only see the backs of our enemies because everyone is literally retreating. And that's all he's seeing.
And this is what fills his head for later on. So he's going to find the town empty. He's going to write to Henry Halleck. And this is a quote now. "To my utter amazement, the enemy hurriedly evacuated the place last night, leaving me everything." Now, by everything, he meant the rebs left everything. Okay. "In the rebels' haste to get across the river to Tennessee, they left 33 cannon, thousands of rifles, a whole bunch of ammo, wagons, their entire supply of DQ gift cards, as well as horses and mules. They left everything. They just got up and they took off. McCown, for whatever reason, just walked away from it. Now, Pope and his army, they're going to control New Madrid. And now their control of New Madrid is going to directly endanger Island Number 12. Island Number 10. It's only 7 miles away, right on the river. The only downside is that Foote's boats have not arrived yet. So he can't chase the rebs into Tennessee while they're retreating. He's got to sit there and wait.
Yep.
And the next day, Pope is going to set up artillery under Major Warren Lathrop along the riverbank facing Tennessee, where members of the 5th Wisconsin under Captain Oscar Finney are going to test the range of these new rebel targets across the river. An artillerist from the 5th Wisconsin named William Ball set up the practice shots. One hit a parapet of an enemy fortification. One struck a house across the river on the water's edge. One fell near a Confederate horseman in a cornfield. It was all good considering the distance and lack of experience. They were just sitting around firing guns at things. And then they moved. The rebs would fire back here and there, but basically there was only one federal casualty. So it was just kind of benign overall. The next day was March 15th. And this was the day Pope is anxiously awaiting for to finally arrive.
Yep.
It was the day when Foote's flotilla finally arrives from their work on the Cumberland River at Forts Henry and Donelson. Now, Foote, we're going to talk about him in a second.
Yep.
He's a cautious fellow, Mary. He's a very cautious fellow.
I don't blame him
for that. And he stopped on the way to repair his boats that were damaged, that were sustained at Fort Donelson before putting him into harm's way. His fear was he did not want to lose any of these boats. That was the big deal. Now, what you got to know about the Mississippi is the currents run south. So if a boat got disabled on the Mississippi, it was going to sail south right into the hands of the Confederacy. And that's what he didn't want.
He didn't want that because, I mean, obviously, I think they had better boats than the Confederacy, and he didn't want them falling into his hands at all. But as you said, Foote is, he's a really interesting guy. I didn't know much about him until this episode, which, I mean, admittedly, the Navy is not an area of the Civil War that I'm very well versed in. I have become more well versed in it since doing this podcast, but it's great that when we do these episodes, I learn a little bit more about it. So Flag Officer Andrew Foote is, he's born in 1806 in New Haven, Connecticut. He studies at West Point for 6 months in 1822, but he leaves to join the Navy as a midshipman on the USS Grampus, amazing name, by the way. And Foote is going to travel all over the world. He's going to go to the Caribbean, he's going to go to the Pacific, the Mediterranean, and the African coast. In 1837, he will circumnavigate the globe aboard the USS John Adams. He's also a very committed advocate of temperance. So I could see him and Howard, there's my Howard reference for this episode, being very good friends. In 1843, he succeeded in making the USS Cumberland the first completely dry ship in the Navy. And he also is credited with the total elimination of the spirit ration in the Navy by 1862, which is, I found that really, really interesting. I was like, wow, I had no idea that was even a thing.
Is it possible to be on a boat and not drink? Is that impossible?
I don't know. I was like, oh, really? Oh, my grandfather was a sailor, and I can tell you he would not have stood for that.
He would have hated you.
So Foote is also an abolitionist. In the early 1850s, he's going to patrol the African coast looking for slave ships. He also believed in the efforts of the American Colonization Society in Liberia, very similar to what Abraham Lincoln believed in that for a while as well. So even though he's an abolitionist, he is into this whole like colonizing Liberia as well. In 1856, Foote is promoted to commander of the USS Portsmouth in the Asian Squadron. And during the Second Opium War, which, interesting name, can't imagine what they were fighting over, Foote personally led a landing party and destroyed four Chinese forts after being fired upon from the shore. In 1858, Foote is going to return to the United States and take command of the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which is where he's going to be in 1861 when the Civil War begins. And he was quickly sent west, which is obviously where we're finding him in this episode about Island Number 10, to prepare for a river invasion of the South. And when the Civil War began, he wrote a letter to his children. "God grant that you all may at least rest in heaven, my dear children, is the prayer of your affectionate father." And this is, in a way, a sad foreshadowing, because in 1862, he is going to lose three of his children. William, age 13, will pass away. Later that year, his daughter Emily, at the age of 10, and 6 days after that, his daughter Maria, at the age of 7, is going to pass away. So we were talking about this earlier before we recorded the episode, but these guys, like, I mean, you think about someone like John Bell Hood loses a lot of his children. Longstreet also loses a lot of his children. This happens before and after the Civil War, obviously.
Sherman, obviously.
But Sherman with his son Willie, even Abraham Lincoln, like they all, like they're losing their kids. And it's incredibly sad some of the lives these guys led. And here they are still fighting battles, right? And you know, you have Foote that 1862 has been an incredibly like not a good year for him. And it's quite frankly not going to get any better, as we're going to see at the end of the episode. But one thing about Foote, he has a very good working relationship with General Grant. He is the leading role in Fort Henry on February the 6th, which we already talked about. But in his attack on Fort Donelson, Foote was turned back and he was also wounded, ironically, in his foot. So he's on crutches during Island Number 10. But this attack on Donelson psychologically had some kind of effect on him. And he would later be more cautious, whereas before that, he was kind of like, let's get in and do this. And I don't think it's like a mistrust of any of the commanders. I think it's just that like he was like, shit, like this was a bad situation I was in and I don't want to ever be in this situation again. And that really, like the psychology of that really factors into his performance at Island Number 10, how he's very much like, you know, Pope, as we're going to see, is going to suggest he do stuff and he's going to be very apprehensive. He's going to be very like, I don't want to lose, as you said, any of these ships to the Confederates, because if we do, that's going to be bad news for us. But like Foote was a really interesting study and also just a guy who like, you know, he's one way before Henry and Donelson and he completely changes after that too, I think, to the point where, you know, not just his wounding is going to affect him, but just this whole how cautious he is. He's not the kind of the fighter he once was after whatever happened to him at Forts Henry and Donelson.
Well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, he became very, very cautious. I mean, obviously Pope wants him to attack pretty quick and Foote's like, oh, I don't know, Davey. I mean, that's just the way.
Yeah.
He just wasn't. But you know, the thing about it though, the arrival of Foote's squadron of those seven ironclads was huge. I mean, this flotilla included the ironclads USS Benton, Mound City, St. Louis, Carondelet, we're going to talk about, Louisville, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, as well as Timberclads, Conestoga, in a transport boat, 14 motorboats, in a partridge and a pear tree. Yeah. That's how much this guy's. So there's a whole bunch of stuff coming. So by 9 o'clock in the morning on March 15th, this whole fleet is steaming down the Mississippi and they're coming, they're approaching Island Number 10. Now Foote immediately, you know, saw the danger and messaged Nate his, you know, he basically messaged his Navy commander, Gideon Wells. And he realized this is not going to be a milk run. He writes, and I quote, "Island 10 is harder to conquer than Columbus, and the island shores are lined with forts, each fort commanding the other above it." So what does he see? He sees this island loaded with guns. He sees on his left on the Tennessee shore, a grand total combined 52 guns all aimed. And so he knows the island is small, but he knows it's going to be a tough place to seize. So when he gets there, he's going to notice you know, like we said before, the Mississippi River's their currents are really too strong to launch an attack when, as soon as he gets there. Those spring rains we talked about have flooded the entire area. There's swamps all along the side of the river. They're all
the Rosewood's clown is probably in them.
Oh yeah, the whole thing. So, but he knew that he's going to need to be patient. Even for him, he's going to need to be patient. So, what is he going to do? He's going to use those 11 mortar boats under the command of Henry Maineater, and that's what he's going to do. Start using them first. These mortar boats, by the way, they're 50 feet long. 230-pound shells they fire, 13 inches long, with a range of 2.5 miles. Yep. Holy crap. These are big guns. He's going to start blasting again, hoping these mortars themselves can take out the island and take out all these rebel reinforcements on the Tennessee shore.
Yep.
Abraham Lincoln, the guy with the hat, he hears about all these mortars and these powerful guns. He's all excited. Here's a quote Lincoln said when he heard what Foote was doing. He gleefully says, "Here is gunpowder to rain the rebels out by treating them to a refreshing shower of sulfur and brimstone." Holy crap.
Little does he know that the mortars aren't really overly effective against the Confederates, though.
No, exactly. Yeah. He doesn't know that.
Yeah.
By September, March 16th, Foote is going to test out these mortar raiders again, and he's going to have some of his gunboats kind of recon the area a little bit. He's going very slow-footed. Watch, see what I did there,
yeah.
Right? That's kind of what he does. The next day, St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, the gunboat USS Mound City is going to open up on these rebel positions on the Tennessee shoreline, and they're going to pound Captain Edmund Rucker's battery on the in the Belmont battery that happens in the tip of island number 10. So now he's slowly kind of progressing up, right?
But he's still very cautious with that.
He is. Like, he's going slow.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, though. The rain is affecting the rebels, too. The Confederates are trying to fire back, but guess what happens? When the rebels are firing their guns, the ground is so soft, they start sinking into the mud.
Yeah.
They start going
well, when
down.
You're on, like, I mean, if you're on island number 10, you're on a sandbar. And
right.
it's really just the geography of the area, with it being the Mississippi and just being a sandbar, you're going to be, you know, prone to flooding and all that. And that's one of the things that they're starting to run into.
No, the Rebs are talking about the fact that the artillerists are up to their knees in mud while they're firing. They're sinking, too. Mm. That's what's going on. You know, and then just only imagine. But despite this back and forth, there's very little damage being done on either side. The USS Cincinnati is going to get hit, as well as the Benton. But really, there are 3 Union casualties on this initial assault, and only 2 rebels get killed. So this is all guns exploded. Nothing's really going on. Most of the Union shells, all they succeeded was doing was blowing mud up in the air. That's all they really did. Finally, by 7 p.m. on St. Paddy's Day, Foote says, enough of this. He starts to pull his boats back. But he is going to leave those 11 mortar boats there.
Yeah.
And they're going to keep firing throughout the night on island number 10, which is going to, at this point, kind of turn into a siege. Just keep firing back and forth.
Yeah, it's a siege. And they, like March 20th, Foote calls a council of war for his captains. And, you know, Pope has been on him, like, you need to run the batteries. We have to get together, because that's what's keeping them apart. And that's what's keeping them from taking, you know, getting island number 10, getting over to the shore, other shore where they need to be. And so Foote calls this council of war, and they're like, yeah, we can't run by the batteries. It's not good. And then Halleck is writing him saying, like, dude, you need to give all your assistance to Pope that you can. And of course, like, he's also getting, like, contradictory reports. He's also having to report to Gideon Wells. Like, I can't imagine, like, how Foote is right now. He's like, who's my boss right now? Like, who's my supervisor? Meanwhile, you also have this, there's a canal that has been dug that by Pope, one of Pope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that in a second, because that's a cool real story. But the thing too, on the Confederate side, I mentioned before how, you know, how basically McCown had left New Madrid.
Yes.
And he just left it. Well, the hammer's going to fall on him now. Is the Rebs, the governor finds out what he did at this point, and for leaving New Madrid without a fight, and they're going to replace him with a guy named William McCall. Now, William McCall is an adjutant from Albert Sidney Johnson's staff from Maryland.
Yes.
Okay, so he's going to replace. McCown is going to be sent away to Fort Pillow, and there are going to be rumors that he was drunk and the usual Civil War stuff. It's going to be debunked later on, and he's going to be vindicated, but that's what's going to happen. William McCall is going to arrive on March 31st. Now, I know we're going to go back. We're going to jump around time, but when he gets there, he's going to learn that McCown left. He took all of his staff. He took five regiments and every piece of info they had on Pope's army. He left him blind.
So it's kind of like when Meade came into charge at Gettysburg. I mean, not that. I mean, this sounds a little bit worse. He has no idea what's going on because
he leaves him blind. So McCall is going to end up with only 2,300 men left to defend Island Number 10. Mm. And oh, and by the way, the 2,300 men he left behind, they were left behind. You know why? Because most of them had the measles.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful.
He took the healthy guys and left the sick guys and said, the hell with this. I'm out of here.
I've had the measles. It is not fun. I don't recommend.
No, absolutely not. So McCall's going to start all over again, and he's going to do his own recon. And when he does, this is what we talked before, he's going to learn about what Pope and Foote are up to. Okay. Now, you know, Foote, we mentioned before, you said before, he's just like you said, he's weary of sending the guns past Island Number 10. He doesn't know what he's going to do. Because of all the rains we mentioned before, the swamps surrounding the river are completely flooded, and Pope and Foote thought of a way, like you said, to possibly circumvent the island altogether for this attack. Now, this is a cool story because it's foreshadowing of something that's going to come later on with the DeSoto Canal in Vicksburg. And this is where they got the idea from. So basically, what's going to happen is Pope and Foote are going to try. They want to cut a path through the swamp at Wilson's Bayou that's going to connect to a place called St. John's Bayou that leads right to New Madrid. Now, this plan was first thought of by guess who? Schuyler Hamilton.
Yeah.
That's who he thinks about. And an engineer named Josiah Bissell. Okay. 600 of his men are going to be called upon to build it. Now, the thing about this thing is that I can only imagine how this whole thing must have went. It's going to require an effort to basically cut down trees, many of which are 5 feet underwater.
Yeah.
And maneuver through all this swampy crap and muck to cut a path big enough to allow transport boats to get through and bypass Island Number 10. All this while avoiding the Rosewood Swamp Clown. That's a whole new thing we got to deal with now. And this canal is going to be used for just the transport boats. They're not going to use them for the gunboats. It's going to be 12 miles long. That's how long this thing's going to have to be. Now, McCall, the new Confederate commander there, you know, he knows what the rebels are up to.
Yeah.
But he doesn't pay much attention to it because he thinks it's a freaking waste of time. There's no chance they're going to pull this thing off.
Well, there's more stuff starting to happen elsewhere that is, I think, diverting the attention of more than a few people at this point. Because you think of the date, we're mid-March 1862.
No, but the thing about it, though, is believe it or not, this canal succeeded. They freaking did it. They did it in just 19 days. Just think about that. And basically, before long, they're going to get four steamboats, transports through this thing called Pope's Canal. Sometimes it's called Bissell's Canal.
Yep.
That's going to lead right to New Madrid. Now, from here, Pope's plan is pretty simple. Once he gets these transport boats, he can use them to carry his men across the Mississippi, down south of the Mississippi, and they're going to get behind rebel lines. They're going to block their retreat on that lone strip of land at Tiptonville, Tennessee. So again, he's moving the chess pieces, and this is where Pope is really good here. If things go well, he could destroy Island Number 10, opening up the Mississippi. He can bag the entire rebel garrison all at once. But he still needed one thing to do. One thing had to work. He needed Foote's gunboats to run Island Number 10.
Yep.
And just to set the back on Island Number 10, things suck. It's miserable. It's cold. It's wet. It just you can just imagine. It's
flood, like, I mean, the flooding and all that. But as you said, they need to have these gunboats to kind of run the gauntlet. You know, this is kind of, I mean, the part of this part of Island Number 10 is kind of a smaller part, kind of a smaller version of what happens in the Vicksburg campaign. Like, you look at Island Number 10, and in some ways it's like this kind of micro version of Vicksburg in what happens here. But as I mentioned, on March 20th, Foote has called a council of war, and everybody's like, F this, we are not doing this. We can't risk losing these gunboats. By March 29th, they're like, we have to start doing something, and we have to do it now. So Foote ends up calling a second council of war. And Henry Walk of the USS Carondelet, which, yes, if you study the Vicksburg campaign, that name is going to be familiar to you. The Carondelet is used in that campaign as well. And Henry Walk says, this is worth the risk. And he volunteers his book or his boat to basically run the gauntlet to say, I will go by them in this, and we can get by them. So they end up, it takes a little bit. It's a few days before they can, before, you know, they're able to actually do this because they're waiting for the right conditions. But what they have to do with the Carondelet before they do this is they have to cover it in rope, chain, whatever loose material they have. There's going to be a coal barge filled with coal and hay that is going to be lashed to the side of this boat. And they had to wait until dark to make the run. And it's into April when it's finally able to happen, and they have to get past Island Number 10. And they almost make it, except some smoke escapes. And
let's not jump ahead, because that's a cool thing, okay? Because the Rebs know that if they get past this island, they're screwed. And this is the thing, as they mentioned before, they know what's coming. They know they do. And on April 3rd, you know, one of the rebel engineers on the island is going to write to General McCall. And he's going to write to him. He's going to say, the water batteries on the main shore and island will be able to beat the enemy's boats back by daylight, but they will be able to or not prevent them from passing during a dark and boisterous night. The future alone can disclose. Okay. And so the Rebs are actually being helped by the fact that Foote's kind of sitting back and not doing anything. The mortars aren't doing anything, but thinking they can destroy, because the mortars aren't going to do it. But like you said, Foote is now getting pressure now to go ahead and do this and run this. Pope is sitting at New Madrid, but Foote still fears losing his boats. He doesn't want to lose his boats.
But he's got a guy that is like, I can do this.
Right. But finally Foote has that moment where he has that come to Jesus moment and says, you know what? I'm going to have to risk one of my toys. And he's got to send one of the gunboats. And you mentioned that the USS Carondelet under Henry Walk. So like you said, he's going to volunteer his services to test out these island defenses and get through him. Now, he can't just run the boat. He needs help. This is going to be a joint attack where he's going to have 40 men from the 42nd Illinois under Colonel George W. Roberts, who is going to launch a nighttime raid on that Rucker's battery on the Tennessee shore and spike the guns. That's what he's going to want to do, because they got to take out as many of these guns as possible before they send the USS Carondelet down. And the other obstacle they had to deal with was that CSS New Orleans, that floating battery I mentioned at the very, very beginning. It's sitting on the northwest side of Island Number 10. It's a big flat barge that's just loaded up with guns. And it's a real pain in the ass. They have to figure out a way to disable this. So what do? On April 3rd, the USS Benton, the USS Cincinnati, and three mortar boats are all going to target the CSS New Orleans to disable it. They're going to focus, instead of their guns, on the Tennessee shore or on Island Number 10, they're going to zero in on this boat. And if they can do it, the Carondelet is going to have an easy mission, because there'll be no guns to run by. You got the 42nd Illinois, these Roberts guys, they can take out the Tennessee side, and you can have the Benton, Cincinnati, and those three mortars can take out the New Orleans. Well, then it's a milk run. So Roberts, so on the night of the 3rd, everything gets going. Roberts, 42nd Illinois, despite in the pouring rain, because it's always raining, they are able to do it. They get across and they spike those 40 guns from Rucker's battery. Mm-hmm. Right up the big, big, huge piece of the puzzle taken care of. Now, nighttime on the CSSO of New Orleans, right, sees the boat getting pounded over and over and over again by these boats, to the point when the captain, Samuel Averitt, is going to cut the cables and float away.
And just be like, bye.
And judging by my reaction, you're not an Arlo Guthrie fan, but that's okay. we'll leave that alone, okay? But what's going to happen is they're going to cut the moorings and they're going to say, we got to go. They're going to start floating, like I said, south down the Mississippi, because the current's going to take them. They're not going to stop until they get 2 miles away. And by now, they're completely off the dance floor, at least for a while. The morning of April 4th arrives, and the USS Carondelet is set to go.
Yep.
And like you said before, they're going to spend the day covering the side with hay, from all that stuff you mentioned.
There's rope and chain, the barge.
Right.
Next to
they're it. Also going to have, they're also going to have 42 sharpshooters on board from the 42nd Illinois join them to try to pick off things that they can along the way if they need them. So they're going to have to wait, like you said, wait for nightfall to go. Another thunderstorm is going to hit right as the Carondelet begins to float downstream. The men are all told to be very, very quiet.
Yep.
They're told no orders above a whisper. The only light that's going to be allowed on the boat is in the engine room. They're told to be very, very, very quiet. So despite the flashes of lightning that are going on back and forth, the Carondelet sails right by the guns on Tennessee that are left without a hitch.
Yep.
They're going to approach island number 10, and it looks like they're going to fly right past the island. This is going way too easy, okay? And like you said, something goes wrong.
There's some smoke that comes out of one of the smokestacks that wasn't supposed to happen, and then Confederates kind of see them. Luckily, it's at the last minute, and they do start to fire on them.
Well, it's more than smoke. Yeah. It's fire.
Yeah.
I mean, flames shoot through the chimney like a 1967 Shelby Cobra. They're flying right through it. It lights up the whole area like New Year's Eve on January 1st in New York City.
Yep.
All of a sudden, all the troops nearby are firing small arms fire at the boat. The artillerists are running to their positions to get this boat going by. To your point, it's already almost gone by.
Yep.
So they're kind of beyond it. And by the time the Rebs are at that heavy artillery, for the most part, it's too late. There's not a lot going on. The ones that did get to the guns struggled because of the weather. The visibility they couldn't see. All they could see was the fire and the lightning going on. So the Carondelet sails by island number 10, for the most part, unscathed. The last obstacle to New Madrid was that CSS New Orleans, which was now 2 miles down the river. But by then, it was beaten up a little bit. It just sailed right by it.
Yep.
So this is going perfectly. Ironically, the only issue they had was self-inflicted. When the Carondelet approaches New Madrid, it runs ashore 50 yards too early and lands on a sandbar. But by 1 o'clock in the morning on April 5th, the gunboat's now sitting safely at the dock after this two-hour trip. In the end, the Confederates fired only 47 shots at the Carondelet, hitting only two times with no damage. And while this is all going on, guess what? Those transport ships that sailed through that newly created Pope's Canal, they've arrived.
Yeah, so he's got his supplies that he needs. Like, you know, Pope's in good shape, like, going, like, you know, because of what's happened. But again, like anybody who has studied the Vicksburg campaign, if you're thinking, wow, this sounds familiar, it is. You know, this is definitely like island number 10. Like when I was, you know, researching it, I thought like, oh my God, this is like so much, like there's so many parallels with Vicksburg, with what's happening with this kind of running by, like silently by. And you have to wonder if inspiration for Grant in planning what he did was taken from what Walk and Foot do here and what Pope does here, because it's eerily similar in many respects to that.
Oh, it does. And, you know, with the Carondelet arriving safely, that gunboat, Pope immediately orders a second one through the same thing on the night of April 6th. This would be the USS Pittsburgh. And they're going to successfully make it past aisle number 10-2 and arrive in New Madrid around 5 a.m. on April 7th. So now with two gunboats at his disposal, John Pope sends them down the river to destroy those rebel batteries at Watson's Landing.
Yep.
And this is going to be the location where the infantry was targeted to land for their overland attack on island number 10 to get all the troops now. So once that's completed, those four transport boats that made it through the canal, they're going to be loaded up. And four barges with 3,000 men apiece are going to carry them down the river, and they're going to do a landing point on the Tennessee side. This is going to be behind the rebel troops north, who are up north at island number 10. So yeah. Now, for the most part, the rebs are surrounded. Confederate General McCall, he knows the jig is up now.
Oh, yeah.
So
he's like, well, my position is hopeless.
Well, he's got the Navy. He's completely surrounded.
Yep.
So he's going to order a general retreat from the island. He's going to say, the hell with this. And they're going to begin to move those men on the Tennessee side down the peninsula toward Tiptonville.
Yep.
Okay. And this terrain, again, is protected. That the terrain that protected them up to this point is going to be their enemy. Because like I said, on their left is going to be the Real Foot Lake, that swamp the earthquake created. On their right's the Mississippi. There's a small land peninsula they have to walk down. And now this 9,000 to 12,000 federal troops sitting there waiting for them, just sitting there tipped and they're waiting. And so they're basically trapped. By the time they did make it to Tiptonville, Pope's infantry, they were sitting there waiting for them. They bagged the whole garrison.
Yeah, Pope had spies everywhere. And he these guys are going there. And he knew to send them there. And they end up being trapped. And Mackle is just like, I'm done. I surrender. Because he has no choice.
They all completely surrendered, the whole garrison. John Pope and Andrew Foote's plan worked perfectly, and they achieved a gigantic, gigantic victory. But the newspapers didn't report it like they normally would.
No. Nope.
Because on the same day, they were reporting about all these incredible losses in Pittsburgh Landing at a battle called the Battle of Shiloh that was happening at the same exact time. So the siege or battle of Island Number 10 in Shiloh ended on the same day, less than 200 miles apart, and few to this even today even know this. So back then, that Battle of Shiloh completely overshadowed everything John Pope did. When you think of John Pope, like we said before, you think of his errors at First Manassas, right?
Yeah.
Then you think of his really bad errors at Second Manassas, and then you may know about his little the Dakota War thing. But this was his big moment, and it was completely overshadowed. The Battle of Island Number 10 is important because it was a pivotal first step in opening the Mississippi River and was a dagger to the heart of the Confederacy economy in that area, that slave-holding area. In less than 60 days, because of the fall of Island Number 10, Memphis fell. Right? So it would prove to be basically, like you said, a practice for the Vicksburg campaign, from digging the canal to running the boats past the guns. This was all first tried and successfully attempted at the Battle of Island Number 10. But it's not a household battle because of other things that were going on at the same exact time. But it cannot be understated how, in real time, in real life, how important Pope and Foote's success was in basically unclogging the Mississippi River, because everything that comes after this on the Mississippi is because they did what they had to do at Island Number 10.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't get studied.
No, and we're not downplaying what happened at Shiloh at all. What we're saying is study this one as well, because it is so important because basically you have the Mississippi River open right until Fort Pillow. And that is extremely important. It's going to factor into the Vicksburg campaign, which is going to be starting to happen soon after this. It's going to start. And you have, anyone who's studied it, there are so many parallels with this, with Walk and the Carondelet kind of running that gauntlet, with digging a canal as well, which I think McPherson, He's in the
this canal worked. DeSoto did.
McPherson's did not work. I think McPherson was involved in the DeSoto. It did not work. It's really kind of paving the way for Vicksburg to happen. And that's the one thing that, you know, we've always said is these smaller battles, these ones that don't get talked about enough, they are factoring into these bigger things, kind of like Second Winchester factors into a lot of, you know, Gettysburg. Just little things like that. But this island number 10 is definitely worth studying. It's so interesting. It's a side to John Pope that you don't normally see. Someone like Foote does not get studied enough. Even McCall on the Confederate side, you know, he doesn't get studied. McCall, sorry, whatever. Sorry, I can never pronounce it. McCall, I don't know, McCall. He is taken prisoner after island number 10. But he's going to be exchanged on August 15th, 1862. And he's going to have various staff positions after that. Notably, he's going to be with Braxton Bragg in the Army of Tennessee, who had been his classmate at West Point. And after Chickamauga, he's like, I'm done. I want to be relieved. And that's at his own request. And they relieve him. And then he's going to go and do, he's going to be with the Department of Mississippi in East Louisiana. And then he's going to serve as chief of staff for General Joseph E. Johnston. And he is going to decline to serve with Army of Tennessee when General John Bell Hood replaces Johnston. And then he's going to be in command of Confederate forces in South Georgia between March 23rd, 1865 and April 20th, 1865. And he's going to be he's going to be captured by Union troops again. And he's going to pass. So he ends up getting a farm in Fairfax, Virginia. And that's where he passes away in 1891. Is in Fairfax, Virginia.
Exactly. And but the overall point is people talk about the importance of Vicksburg falling. What's more important? Gettysburg in the east, Vicksburg, you know, in the Mississippi. Vicksburg doesn't happen if Pope and Foote don't break out on every 10.
Because they have to open up that area of the Mississippi. Just like Chickamauga, you know, you think about it, like you get Vicksburg and then all of a sudden you get Chattanooga. And it's this kind of this rolling effect in the Western theater, which, in my opinion, still doesn't get studied enough for its kind of the strategic victories that happen there that are so key in the ending of the Civil War, because it's cutting off the Confederate supplies. It's cutting off that heartland where they have a lot of those plantations, where a lot of the slavery is.
If you're in the area, there's not much left of Island Number 10. It's been erosions washed it away. It's for the most part, it's underwater right now. There's different islands that pop up here and there, but this island specifically we're talking about doesn't really exist anymore. So if you're a reenactor from Island Number 10, you're probably Aquaman realistically at this point. But the reality is, we joke, but in seriousness, the Vicksburg campaign is created because of what Pope and what Foote do here. Yeah. Now Foote's is going to come along later on with Vicksburg as he is, but Pope is going to get sent east. He's going to have his issues and the whole thing is going to fall apart with him. But again, this is probably his best moment because he captures New Madrid without a shot. He's able to create a plan to capture Tiptonville and bag that whole Confederate army in that area and really rob the Confederacy of a real economic boon. A lot of money was there. There was a huge slave owning population. There was a big part of the bloodline of their economy in the Mississippi that they stopped. So if you study this, and again, it's a funny aim of a battle, but it's an important one. Like you said a little while ago, every little battle leads to a big battle. Mm. Vicksburg doesn't happen if Island Number 10 doesn't happen. And it's just one of those things we put to study. So I think it's a good place to drop off at this point. I think it's an important study. So definitely check it out. People who live in the New Madrid area, if you live that area, you certainly know about this battle, but I think a lot of people in the mainstream probably don't.
No, I didn't really study it all that much until we did. And just to wrap up about Foote. So in May of 1862, he ends up taking leave to recover from the wound he had sustained at Donelson, which was ironically in his foot. He's promoted to Admiral in July of 1862, and he ends up having a bureaucratic role that he doesn't really like. I mean, if you think about his history, he's always been, you know, he's involved in the Navy. He's been very active in his command. So something like a bureaucratic position probably would not suit him. In 1863, Foote agreed to take command of the South Atlantic blockading squadron, but on his way there, He is suddenly struck with what is called Bright's disease, and he passes away in New York City on June 26, 1863. His second wife passes away 2 months after him, and their youngest son, Samuel, is going to be orphaned at the age of four. And he has two sons from his other marriage as well, but his youngest is going to be is going to be an orphan. So Foote kind of leads, like, as I said, he's lost some kids in 1862, leads kind of a tragic life in a way, and he passes away June 26, 1863.
Well, he's interesting. You think a lot of people like Foote, you think about Farragut, people like that with the Navy. We don't do a lot of brown water navies. So this is one that's we're happy to do. So what's coming up for us next, Mary? What's coming on the pike for us? So what's sailing down the river for us?
So sailing down the river, we are going to be having, our next episode is going to be, we're going to have guest Dr. Alan Guelzo is going to be joining us to talk about his new book that he has coming out. And then after that, our next episode is going to be about General Lew Wallace. So we're going to be focusing on the life of another general again, which we are really looking forward to talking about Lew Wallace. He's involved at Shiloh, which just had the anniversary of Monocacy. He's kind of, you know, saves Washington, D.C., battle that saved Washington, D.C. And then he's also involved in Cincinnati as well. And he has some stuff, obviously, afterwards, after the Civil War, that is worth talking about as well. So he's going to be our next general. And we have our book club coming up this Tuesday night, April 16th. It's not too late to join us. CivilWarBreakfastClub@gmail.com. We are going to be talking with retired Colonel Ed Lowe about his book about Longstreet, A Fine Opportunity Lost, which is about the Knoxville campaign.
The Knoxville campaign, a very important study. There's a lot of people study about it. So we're going to talk with our friend Ed. He's going to be great to do that. We'll be meeting with Dr. Guelzo on next week. We'll talk about his book, Notes from Gettysburg, a book that's coming out in May that we'll talk about. And then, of course, we have Lew Wallace. So off we go, Mary. Any final words from you, Finchero?
No, thanks for bringing it, as you always do. This was a really great one to study. I encourage anybody that has studied Vicksburg and really loves it to look at Island Number 10 a little bit more, find the parallels with it, and find, you know, just the stuff that kind of, you'll be like, wow, this sounds really familiar when you're studying Island Number 10.
It definitely is. So off we go. Everyone, thanks for listening. We appreciate it. Have a great rest of the weekend, Mary. Go Boston College, beat Denver. See if we get ourselves another banner. So off we go. So everyone have a great, safe weekend. We will talk to you all, as they say, on the other side.
See y'all later.
Peace out. Bye.